This episode is brought to you by B2G Global Strategies, for whom I proudly serve as CEO. B2G is an international security and investigations firm whose clients include some of the leading individuals and companies around the world. Our services include forensic accounting, anti-money laundering, cyber investigations, due diligence investigations, and security and threat assessments. You can learn more at b2gstrategies.com. This is Matthew Craig Kelly, host of The Looking Glass. The Jeffrey McDonald case has produced a half century of documentation, including multiple legal proceedings, as well as a number of books and documentary films. It is one of those stories that has given rise to a range of interesting subplots, few of which we explore in our 10 episodes for season 1 of The Looking Glass. So we thought we would explore one or two of these subplots in mini episodes. While Fatal Vision is the book most widely associated with the Jeffrey McDonald case, a second case-related book that has generated much discussion over the years is Janet Malcolm's The Journalist and the Murderer, which was published in 1990. The book's opening line, in particular, has gained a measure of fame, or infamy, depending upon whom you ask. It reads, "Every journalist who is not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what is going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible." Translation, journalists manipulate their subjects. They earn their subjects' trust only to betray it. Malcolm made this claim about all journalists, but she had one in particular in mind, Joe McGinnis. And while McGinnis had written about many subjects over the years, Malcolm had one in particular in mind, Jeffrey McDonald. The Journalist and the Murderer makes a fairly ironclad case that in publishing Fatal Vision, Joe McGinnis betrayed Jeffrey McDonald. A little context is in order. Joe McGinnis first met Jeffrey McDonald in 1979, shortly before McDonald's case went to trial. McGinnis was writing for a local Los Angeles publication at the time and had gotten wind of McDonald's impending trial and also of the fact that McDonald was then practicing medicine in Southern California. He found the situation, particularly McDonald's standing trial for a crime that military authorities had cleared him of a decade earlier, intriguing and novel. By all accounts, including both McGinnis's and McDonald's, the two men took an instant liking to one another and got along famously. Like almost everyone else who met McDonald, McGinnis found the doctor charismatic, articulate, and highly intelligent. For his part, McDonald enjoyed McGinnis's biting East Coast wit and admired his professional accomplishments. The two also had a lot in common. As Errol Morris writes, McGinnis and McDonald were roughly the same age. McGinnis was born on December 9, 1942, McDonald on October 12, 1943, less than a year apart. Both came from lower middle class families. Both were on the fast track. McGinnis in 1969 had published a bestseller, The Selling of the President in 1968. McDonald had gone to Princeton, received early admission to medical school at Northwestern, and became a Green Beret doctor with a promising career ahead of him. Both had married early and had been unfaithful to their wives. Also, prior to the murder of McDonald's family, he and McGinnis had both had two young daughters. The rapport between McGinnis and McDonald was such that McDonald asked the author to write a book about his case and promised McGinnis full access both to the trial proceedings and to the defense's case file. McGinnis was game, and no doubt thrilled at the opportunity, but was adamant that he retain full creative control of the book. Although his attorneys were less than comfortable with this scenario, they ultimately signed off on the proposal with one proviso. Bernie Siegel asked that one line be added to the contract before it was signed, such that the document's key passage would read, "I, McDonald, realize, of course, that you do not propose to libel me. Nevertheless, in order that you, McGinnis, may feel free to write the book in any manner that you deem best, I agree that I will not make or assert against you, the publisher, or its licensees, or anyone else involved in the production or distribution of the book, any claim or demand whatsoever based on the ground that anything contained in the book defames me." To this passage, Siegel added the phrase, "provided that the essential integrity of my life story is maintained." This phrase would become a kind of legal life raft for McDonald when, on September 18, 1983, 4 years after his conviction at the 1979 trial, he learned that McGinnis's book would not, in fact, be exonerating him. The circumstances of McDonald's moment of truth were about as inauspicious as they come. September 18, 1983 was the season premiere of CBS's immensely popular news show, 60 Minutes. The episode featured an interview with McDonald from prison, wherein the famed journalist Mike Wallace spoke on camera with the now incarcerated doctor. MacDonald knew the piece would take McGinnis's book as its point of reference and was therefore eager to echo and amplify the book's case for his innocence. And then, on camera, he learned the truth. Fatal Vision would not make the case for his innocence, but rather for his guilt. McGinnis had portrayed him as a psychopathic killer whose life had been one long masquerade of decency. Between the 60 Minutes interview and the following year's NBC miniseries version of Fatal Vision, McGinnis had buried Jeffrey MacDonald with the public, or, in MacDonald's view, spit on his grave and stabbed him in the back. The viewing public was completely unaware of this background, of course. They regarded Joe McGinnis as a dogged, truth-seeking investigator who was simply relating his findings to the world, as any good journalist would. It was not until MacDonald filed a lawsuit against McGinnis, culminating in a 1987 trial, that those still following the case would learn of the sordid circumstances culminating in Fatal Vision's 1983 publication. MacDonald's standing to sue the author lay in the line, "provided that the essential integrity of my life story is maintained." MacDonald's lawyers argued that, contrary to preserving the integrity of the doctor's life story, McGinnis had willfully misrepresented MacDonald to the public. Among other things, they contended, McGinnis had solicited from MacDonald private details of the doctor's marriage and sex life on the pretext that these details would not be shared with the public, and then spliced these same compromising details into the text of Fatal Vision as the voice of Jeffrey MacDonald. Enter Janet Malcolm. Malcolm wrote for The New Yorker. Remember that opening line of The Journalist and the Murderer? "Every journalist who is not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what is going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible." Working with the discovery documentation produced at McGinnis's 1987 trial, Malcolm made a powerful case that McGinnis had, in fact, willfully betrayed Jeffrey MacDonald by reassuring him, right up until the point of Fatal Vision's publication, that the book would make the case for MacDonald's innocence. Crucial to Malcolm's argument were a series of letters that McGinnis had written MacDonald after the doctor's 1979 conviction and during the period when McGinnis was writing Fatal Vision. Here are a few examples. Quoting from one of McGinnis's letters to MacDonald, "It's a hell of a thing. Spend the summer making a new friend and then the bastards come along and lock him up. But not for long, Jeffrey. Not for long." McGinnis also wrote MacDonald, "Total strangers can recognize within 5 minutes that you did not receive a fair trial." Again, the journalist wrote these words to the murderer post-conviction. And yet McGinnis told the reporter Mike Wallace that the evidence presented at trial is what had persuaded him of MacDonald's guilt. He likewise told the journalist Bob Keeler, "I knew enough from the day he was convicted so that I would have voted for conviction, as did anybody who spent every day in that courtroom." Try squaring these statements with another McGinnis made in one of his post-conviction letters to MacDonald. "What the fuck were those people thinking of? How could 12 people not only agree to believe such a horrendous proposition, but agree, with a man's life at stake, that they believed it beyond a reasonable doubt?" Malcolm's book struck a serious blow to McGinnis's journalistic reputation, and McGinnis struck back, in a fairly scathing addendum to a future edition of Fatal Vision. But McGinnis was never able to convincingly rebut the most basic facts of his betrayal of MacDonald. His defense was essentially that, in the interim between the 1979 trial's conclusion and the 1983 publication of Fatal Vision, his heart told him one thing, MacDonald couldn't have done it, while his head, increasingly, told him something else, MacDonald committed the murders. This claim just isn't enough to explain away the calculating quality of the letters from which we earlier quoted. Having said that, The Journalist and the Murderer hasn't aged any better than Fatal Vision, particularly since the publication of Mark Smerling's podcast Morally Indefensible just a few years ago. In the course of conducting his research for the podcast, Smerling asked Janet Malcolm if she still possessed the recordings she had made of her interviews with McGinnis during the research phase of The Journalist and the Murderer. She told Smerling she had destroyed those tapes. She hadn't, though, and Smerling got his hands on them. Listening to Malcolm's sympathetic conversations with McGinnis, it quickly becomes clear that she did to him what McGinnis had done to MacDonald, namely, worm her way into the confidence of somebody and then turn around and screw him, to paraphrase the journalist Bob Keeler. We might give Malcolm points for consistency, at least, since she clearly believes that this is just what every journalist does to their subject. But there is something about Malcolm's book that I find more upsetting than her theory of journalistic ethics, and that is her apparent indifference to the question of Jeffrey McDonald's guilt. I'm going to quote a passage now from The Journalist and the Murderer that I think says more about Malcolm than it does about anything else. And I should note that the same passage struck Errol Morris, who gave his own opinion of it in A Wilderness of Error. Quoting, "I asked McDonald about his life in prison, and he spoke for 20 minutes on the subject. You ask this man a question, and he answers it. After my return to New York, and for the next 8 months, I experienced, as McGinnis had experienced, McDonald's exhaustive and relentless responsiveness. The briefest and slightest of inquiries on my part would bring 20-page replies from McDonald and huge packages of corroborating documents. McDonald does nothing by halves, and just as McGinnis had felt oppressed by the quantity of extraneous details in McDonald's tapes, so was I oppressed by the mountain of documents that formed in my office. I have read little of the material he has sent, trial transcripts, motions, declarations, affidavits, reports. A document arrives, I glance at it, see the words bloody syringe, blue threads, left chest puncture, unidentified fingerprints, Kimberly's urine, and add it to the pile. I know I cannot learn anything about McDonald's guilt or innocence from this material. It is like looking for proof or disproof of the existence of God in a flower. It all depends on how you read the evidence. If you start out with the presumption of his guilt, you read the documents one way, and another way if you presume his innocence. The material does not speak for itself." Morris finds this passage disturbing and problematic. I find it repulsive and characteristic of a form of elitist pseudo-intellectualism that is all too typical of The New Yorker and similar publications. The ultimate effect is to get Malcolm off the evidentiary hook. You see, she's too sophisticated to fall into that trap of the simpleton, the idea that with enough empirical commitment and analytical rigor, questions of guilt and innocence actually can be answered. But that takes a lot of work. And why do that work when you could instead navel-gaze and pat yourself on the back for it? Why be diligent when you can dress up your laziness as world-weary wisdom? I hope listeners of this podcast can see that the thrust of what we are doing here runs directly counter to the kind of it's-all-in-how-you-look-at-it mushy-mindedness of the Janet Malcolms of the world. It is, indeed, all in how you look at it, but it does not follow from that that looking is pointless. It follows, rather, that one should look at any intellectual mystery or problem from as many perspectives as possible and make a serious effort to understand how a rational person might hold these various perspectives, and then work from there. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on The Looking Glass.